Dan Bash, I'm Sarah Glynn for Media News, and today I'll be talking politics with two researchers who've written critically about migration control, Mania Petrovska and Najara Achmatshevich. Mania is a researcher at the University of Amsterdam and Your Asian Border Lab, where she focuses on how the European Union has outsourced its border control. Najara is a journalist from Sarajevo who writes about human rights, migration, war crimes, and the role of the media. So Mania and Najara, welcome to Media News.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's a big subject, so let's dive straight in. And my first question is for you, Najara. So migration is a subject that we most often hear about through the filter of politicians' myths. So can you give an overview of the nature of migration today? So where are people coming from? What's making them leave their homes and often at the risk of their lives? And how many of those people are coming to Europe?
Thank you very much. I love this formulation that you use, that we often hear about migration through politician myths. Yes, exactly. It is like that. And what politicians do with these myths is to try to present migration as something that is related to some criminal activity, to terrorism, even something that presents danger, something that we should be afraid of, and something that is almost a new phenomenon. However, all of us are well aware that migration is something that exists as long as we exist in this world, that the whole civilization are based on migrations, and that it's a natural process that brings changes which are more often positive for all of us than negative. Unfortunately, what is happening at the moment is that people who do migrate, especially those who are coming from so-called global south and heading toward the global north, are often presented as a danger for us. And it is based on the racial and religious kind of like the description of the people. And I believe that the way how it is perceived today, and that these myths are very similar to the myths that were spread about different, to put it in this way, people some 60 or 70 years ago during the Second World War and the fascism, era of fascism, which was very dangerous, and we all had to learn a lesson how it ended up. So instead of accepting migration as something natural, as something that all of us benefit, the civilization benefits from, the history benefits from, these political myths are playing for us for the benefits of those who are rich and who do rule the world.
Thank you very much. And moving on from that, to the specifically European situation. Mania, can you outline just briefly how what has been called Fortress Europe has developed and continues to develop its border controls?
Yes. So Fortress Europe is basically something that has been used to describe the EU's preoccupation with securing its external borders. And while this is often seen as kind of a new policy that came into effect with the so-called long summer of migration in 2015, it's been something that has been being developed at the very core of the formation of the European Union. So since this formation of the Schengen Agreement in 1985. So the way this was sold to the public was in order for Europe to be safe and for freedom of movement to be allowed within the internal Schengen borders, we must protect ourselves from the external threat. So Fortress Europe actually started, like, the policies that we kind of see today expanding further were actually initially brought on with the fall of the Soviet Union and the dangerous other from the East. And this was used as justification to fuel these policies. This then was further exacerbated with the US war on terror after the September 11, where migration became conflated with terrorism, and thereby providing justification for exceptional security measures to deal with it. Since then, Fortress Europe has expanded further outwards. So now if we look at EU policy, it's not just about protecting the EU's external borders. EU externalization policies are being introduced in other places such as North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, and even Latin America. So the fortress is indeed expanding, and this is also related to data collection systems. So the European Union is essentially controlling the borders of a lot of the world that we know.
Can you explain a little bit more how that works, and perhaps particularly in the light of the Kurdish interest and the interest in Turkey, the deal that Turkey has with the European Union, but how this externalization works?
Okay, so EU border externalization denotes the strategic outsourcing of border control and migration management to non-EU countries, often with the objective of managing the arrival of migrants and asylum seekers at EU borders. So in this process, so-called EU partner countries such as Turkey receive financial assistance, training and technical support to strengthen their ability to control migration in the interests predominantly of EU markets. So the EU-Turkey deal, which began to take shape in 2015 and was then expanded in 2016, was a $6 billion development assistance funds offered to Turkey to control or withhold people from entering Greece and following down the Balkan route. The Turkey deal in the 2016, it came at the same time as the closure of the Balkan route by the EU. Yeah. The purpose of the Turkey deal is to form an agreement with Turkey to control the movement of people in EU interests. However, a lot of this funding is used, in fact, for border control. So bolstering police forces, implementing data surveillance systems. And yeah, when that is in hands of a leader like Erdogan, you can assume that human rights violations are part of that deal also.
Because, of course, Erdogan initially boasted about the number of refugees that Turkey was taking, portraying Turkey as this very generous state. But now, actually, they're forcing people back against their will, I think, back to Syria, particularly.
Yeah, back to Syria, back to Iran. Iran also. Yeah, there have been numerous pushbacks. Also, there have been instances of border guards shooting at migrants as they try and cross in asylum seekers. So yeah, the human rights violations in terms of securing these externalization policies are not taken into account, obviously, by the EU. The same can be said for the deal with Tunisia. So you have a country with an autocratic leader, but this is all kind of pushed aside in the interests of the EU securing its own migration policy and migration agenda.
Thank you. And just you were referring there, you know, to asylum seeking and the basis of much immigration control. And I'll put this question to you, Najara, that the basis of much immigration control, though I think even this is being undermined, is distinguishing between those people who are under threat and in need of asylum and so-called economic migrants. But can we actually make such a distinction? Is such a distinction possible?
I don't believe it is or it should be. even though that is what exactly is part of this fortification of Europe, or migration management, as organizations that are involved in the process and the states call it. However, I don't even, I mean, that's a very problematic distinction between people, and in this way, rights, basic rights, and one of it is freedom of movement, is taken away from people. And in this way, also, like, somebody puts itself in a position to pick and choose who can stay and who cannot. I don't believe this. This is distinction that should be made. People should be allowed, as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights allowed to us all, basic freedom of movement. But also very important, and for me, it's, I always repeat, is freedom to dream. So if somebody dreams about better life, why he or she has to go through all these burdens and through different administrative procedures in order to be able to dream a better life. So, like, putting and allowing only to some people that some administrative officer believes is in danger or not, freedom to live normal life, is highly problematic. And something we should really think about, how to dismantle the whole process, and how to go back to the universal rights that are guaranteed to all of us. We should insist on that and not accept to be part of this. It's just bureaucracy, nothing more than that. And it's really dangerous for our basic rights.
We can see that people are taking huge risks. They're forced to entrust their lives to people smugglers who are only interested in their money. And every now and then, an especially appalling disaster makes headlines, though we know there are many more deaths in between, and not least in the desert where no one sees what's happening. And I think most people really feel sympathy for the victims of these disasters, but those same people don't want to see their country opened up to unlimited migration. So those people, they're fearful of falling wages, because if you have an increased reserve army of labour in a capitalist system, that's what happens at the bottom. They're concerned about competition for limited housing, and they're concerned about sudden cultural change. So what do you say to those people? Not to the, you know, abstract on a podcast like this, but to the people on the street who are concerned in their communities about migration.
Honestly, I'm not sure that people do really have a chance to express their will. And I'm also, like, going back to your first question when you mentioned political myths. Unfortunately, I think that many people easily fall under these political myths and start thinking in that way. That is not only problem now, but that's propaganda, and this propaganda is very strong. And that's something that we, as a journalist and also as scholars, have to fight with, and have to find a different way to explain what is happening. People on the streets, I'm not sure they really have a voice in this fortress Europe, because their money is used, their taxpayers' money is used to criminalize and to push back people, to impose this fortress. And if we find a way to explain to people that these mechanisms that are used today against one group, which are migrants in this situation, tomorrow will be used against them. And then people will maybe start thinking about other side of this problem, which is a state taking over will of people and diminishing democracy, diminishing our basic rights. So kind of like, and that is what I believe you do with this show, we have to find a way to open different topics and to talk in a different ways about many issues, including migrations. At the same time, I mean, if we do that, we can just remind the people. I mean, that's very easy, about that all of us are migrants. I mean, like if you just hear my surname, Ahmet Aşiric, there are two migrants living in my surname. It's somebody from Ottoman Empire and somebody who came here with the Slavic origin. So all of us have this. Each single person and their ancestor migrated from village to the city, from one country to another country, from one continent to another continent. And we just have to remind ourselves that basically that's what we are. We are migrants and we build the world together. And now suddenly we have some politicians and some bureaucrats who want to destroy that beautiful world that we are building together, like immersed in our different cultures and immersed in our differences. And you know, if we don't do that, we will lose this normality, or we will lose the chance for a normality, and we will become victims of the political myths that are spread through propaganda.
I think this also, this idea that migrants pose a security threat or a job security threat is completely misguided in the context. And I think it's also the way we talk about security in general. It's become a right-wing talking point. So security is seen as state security, which justifies the arms industry, it justifies the border industry. Or in fact, security also should be collaborative security. So security for me personally would be to make sure that I have a house over my head, or I have access to food and water and education. Like that, like we've missed the con like I think we're missing the concept of what security is. So this conflation of migration as a threat to of security has been used to justify the expansion of border control and EU border externalization policies. I think what also was missed that this is necessary for capitalism to function globally, and it's necessary for European markets. By illegalizing migration, what it does is has created a super exploitable workforce within the European Union of people that have no rights to the state, essentially. So work in the black economy, fear deportation, have no access to public support. So you have a super exploitable workforce within the EU. At the same time, this is being justified by like the strict border controls that the EU implements, is being justified by saying we need to stop criminal migration, which just means people crossing without access to visas because a lot of people can't get visas. And yeah, so it illegalizes migration and they open up legal routes, which is labor migration, which allows the EU countries to cherry pick people based on market needs as opposed to people that actually need to migrate to be safe. From the effects of global capitalism.
Yes, sorry. Yes, you want to
Yeah,
add as
may I
well?
just add something? I like if you look around the countries where the biggest number of migrants are poor countries, and I'm not sure that people in these countries are complaining and finding that as problematic or the media as in very rich countries of Northern Europe. And actually, when we talk about criminalization of migration, when we talk about fortification of borders, we are talking about the West. And the problem are not people who are coming from the South, let's put it in that way, but is rather distribution of wealth, and not the people by itself. And people in countries that are not that wealthy as some Northern European countries, they do not fight migrations because, like in Bosnia, I'm coming from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and many citizens here, I mean, this is quite poor country. Many citizens here are very welcoming toward migrants because we are migrants at the same time, and we also look for a better life in some other countries. So we understand this as a normal process where we exchange something, and we when we try to do something to improve situation for all of us together. So I'm really not sure that let's I mean I don't like that term, but ordinary citizen in any country where there are really issues with the jobs will really complain about the migrants, but they will rather complain about unjust system where the wealth is not distributed so that everybody has the same access, the same rights, and the same possibility to provide for oneself.
You. I just want to go back to a point that Manu is making, because I think, in a way, it relates to my question in a slightly sideways way. That if you are talking about the increased reserved army of labor, which if you have more people, you will have, and it makes bargaining more difficult as a worker, but you're actually saying that by having labor controls, then you, I mean, sorry, immigration controls, then you've actually got people who are competing even more cheaply because they can be super exploited because they're illegal. So basically, capitalism wins. Whatever. I mean, the problem is the capitalist system is just going to exploit people one way or the other. Is
Yep,
that?
absolutely. And this fat from Western countries, it's not just the European Union, but also Australia, the US, Canada, to control the borders of the global south and to manage migration and market interests. It's just a way to further exploit people and bolster the economies of these countries. So, yeah, I think that's a point that's often missed, that migration management is literally just a euphemism for Western countries to exploit a global workforce of people in their own interests and manage their movement in their own interests, as opposed to the natural rhythm, as Nadada was mentioning, of populations migrating since the dawn of time. Like, it's something that's encoded within the human DNA, this desire to move, to see new horizons, to try new things. So, yeah.
But perhaps the bigger the pushed migrations, the forced migrations now are also themselves a result of capitalism, which is making so much of the world unlivable, both through exploitation and through war, and increasingly by environmental destruction. So.
Absolutely. And like the funny thing is, if you look at the border industry and the arms industry, so the arms industry, which causes most of, not most, but like a huge amount of people to be forcibly displaced from their homes as refugees, that same industry then profits off the border industry, which then controls their movement or attempts to prohibit it to the West. So since the 1990s, arms industries, the arms industry, like many big arms corporations, actually dedicated a new section for border control. So you can see the contradictions within these processes. The companies that are causing people to flee are then profiting from the states that are trying to stop or control the people from fleeing, entering their own territories.
So for them, not a contradiction, a win-win.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of EU policies are actually being influenced by arms companies. There's been quite a lot of research on this, as well. A lot of lobbying happens. And yeah, it's driven. So it's the EU policies are driven by market interests, but also by these companies that profit from the ever-increasing expansion of border control, which includes arms companies, but also smugglers. But I would say smugglers are a very small amount, but also NGOs, also lots of international organizations, intergovernmental organizations that all profit from the expansion of border control, which leads to border crises from one place to another that just keep migrating, essentially.
So we know that capitalism and the whole system is a problem, is the problem. But in the here and now, if you were not talking to a journalist, but talking to an MEP or a politician who actually could influence, well, MEPs can't much, but a politician perhaps who could influence the European Union's policies, are there any immediate policy changes that you could implement to make things a bit better? So both of you, whoever wants to speak on that.
Yeah. I would change that question a little bit. I want to talk to people. Because people, I want to remind the people that they have the power, that they elect these politicians, that they decide on the on politicians, and that they should be the ones, and they are the ones to impose what they want on politicians. And politicians are there only to do what people want them from them to do. I'm not citizen of the EU. I don't know how does that feel like, and how can I change anything in EU in my country? I can't change anything because it's a very different and strange country. It's protectorate. However, what all of us can benefit from is that people remind themselves that they are what democracy is, and their voice has to be heard, and they have to find a way to make politicians do what they want. I hope they want the world without borders. And that's the only solution that I see for this problem at this moment, is to abolish the borders and the whole border regime that brings profit, as Manya said, only to those who are the richest among us, and to those who are taking the power from the people and taking it in their own hands. It's a very small number of companies. It's not more than 10 companies who are related in different ways to politicians who are in their offices. So the change that I would like to do is to talk to the people and to remind them about the power of the people.
I think first we kind of forget that old forms of racism and prejudice have been bureaucratized in the form of a passport that's created a border apartheid regime where some people are free to travel wherever they want, whereas others are forced to bear the brunt of the impacts of global capitalism, exploitation, war, poverty. So I think first it's that people need to understand that the passport is really like the truest form of hierarchy in our system at the moment. It like based on this piece of documentation, like your rights are determined. Either you have rights, you have lots of rights, or you have none at all. I mean, I think that's something that people don't see. You know, people that I speak to in Europe, or as you said, strange people on the street, I don't think they see the privilege that just a passport and belonging to a particular nation state gives them within this global system. I think if you speak to people about race and discrimination, they have actually a lot to say about that. But there's just a disconnect in understanding how race and discrimination works within the global system today. But yeah, I agree with Najata, we need a world without states and borders. And I think the more people understand the issues that exist within their own lives and within the world more generally, they would actually support such things, which the Kurdish resistance movement is doing a really great job at teaching them about. So